Hey kids, do you like wrestling? Well, we like wrestling too. We are Shake Them Ropes here on the Voices of Wrestling Podcasting Network. Myself and Chris Novembrino kind of doing a lazy river of wrestling criticism, going through the news and whatever happened in stateside television wrestling. And also, you know what? Sometimes we just like to watch old stuff and talk about that too. Love for you to give us a listen if you haven't already. We are Shake Them Ropes here on the Voices of Wrestling Podcasting Network.
This podcast is a member of the Voices of Wrestling Podcasting Network. Visit voicesofwrestling.com to hear the rest of our great podcasts, as well as show reviews, columns, opinions, and updates across the world of wrestling.
Wrestling, well, we like professional wrestling too. This week in the news, WWE doesn't play nice with AEW again. In the lazy river of wrestling criticism, we're going to talk heroes and villains and writing them. And Invader Club Nova selected Rick Martel versus Jumbo Tsuruta for the AWA World Heavyweight Title. This is Shake Them Ropes. I am Jeff Hawkins. He is Chris Novembrino. Rest in peace, George Foreman. George Foreman, in that later comeback in the late 80s, early 90s, is really what kind of kept me into combat sports for a long time. And you think he's much older than he is in that comeback. I think he's in his late 30s, early 40s.
He's like 42 or 43.
42 or 43. But he looks like he moves like he's 60, but he hits like he's like a freight train in those fights. Like, you've watched Michael, like, if you watch his early fights in the 70s when he's like young and svelte, and like, you know, especially against like Ali and things like that, you know, he's a mover and like infamous Rumble in the Jungle fight where Muhammad Ali just says some terrible things about George Foreman in the build to that fight. That were sort of racially tinged, if you look them up too. And that is what George Foreman is most famous for, is being, you know, one of the guys in Ali's way. He of the, you know, Joe Frazier, Muhammad Ali, George Foreman kind of thing. But then when he came back, it was like, you know, everybody was kind of rooting for him. He underwent a complete and total personality change into lovable fuzzball, which is kind of an amazing rebirth when you think about it. And then of course into small appliance pitch man. The famous story there is of course Hulk Hogan is either lying or telling the truth. You can never tell which.
He's definitely lying. I've looked this one up before.
He was originally offered the George Foreman sponsorship of the grill, which basically drains all the taste out of your meat, calling it fat. I loved those George Foreman, like, the Holyfield fight was a fun one. A bunch of us went to some dude's house and watched that, and I was rooting hard for Foreman. Unfortunately, he lost that. The Michael Moore night knockout lives rent-free in my head still, because you're just so amazed by that one. And of course, him naming all his kids George. It's always funny to me. It's just, why? I guess there's a certain arrogance about being a George Foreman where you can get away with such a thing. But,
well, he's the foreman of the Georges.
He's the foreman. he's a literal foreman. There you go.
Yeah, he's a foreman of Georges. Look, George Foreman's comeback in the early and mid 1990s was nothing short of remarkable in terms of an athlete competing in their 40s at a high world championship contender level. George Foreman got video games made after him and stuff on the Super Nintendo and the Genesis. George Foreman's boxing was pretty decent. When he came back, to your point, just, you know, this clubbering dad bod, right? You know, he is a fuzzball of a man. He gets in, he's this big round mound, like watching Charles Barkley box. And
He kind of moves like an iceberg. He's not really moving at all. He just kind of lurches a little bit forward and forward and forward, and just
He's not going to do all seven facets of the Philly shell. Let's put it that way. He's not rolling his shoulders.
No, when you compare to, like, we're just coming out of Mike Tyson being Mike Tyson and then getting kind of dropping off a cliff versus Buster Douglas and then Holyfield and all that other stuff. Foreman comes in and he just kind of barely puts his arms up and just, but then when you hear the impact, it's like you're getting hit with a concrete slab or something. You're just like, my God. And you see a guy's head rock back and you're like, is he really punching with that much force? And it's very deceptive when you watch it. That's the word I was looking for, was deceptive.
Yeah. It's a much more formidable and well-rounded butterbean, essentially. He's just like leveling you with these straights.
And he's going in there against guys who were good but not great all the time. Like Michael Moore's one, Tommy Morrison. I remember that fight. I believe he had a fight with Ray Mercer as well. Guys who were always, you're not as good as Tyson or Holyfield, but you're decent type of a thing. And he'd lose some and he'd win some. The Holyfield fight was an important one because that was when he was at his apex. And, you know, just like, let's see the old man win one. And we had the alphabet soup of boxing back then. I think he won the WBO heavyweight championship, where it wasn't the IBF or the WBC or the WBA. It was this upstart promotion or whatever that needed a heavyweight champion. And so they got one with it. So he was able to call himself a world champion at that time. Boxing really screwed itself in the 90s.
It got very confused. It was at both a high water point for boxing and also just an extraordinarily confusing time in boxing because it was never really clear, like, who the champion was, it felt like.
Yeah, and certain commissions would strip guys of belts for ducking their number one contender to fight somebody else's number one contender, and you're just like... And then eventually, all the stars just left. I think heavyweight boxing's kind of made a comeback, and heavyweight boxing for me was always my favorite. I like the light guys. I think I like technique. I like winning on points and stuff like that. But give me the big boys knocking dudes out, and I'm here for them. You know, the Klitschko brothers I loved, and then eventually, you know, the Tyson Fury fights have always been fun. But there's not that. It's not as big.
Lennox Lewis was sort of the end of heavyweight boxing in that era. Once it got to Lennox, kind of slowed down.
Yeah, and Lennox wasn't a power guy. He was a technique guy. He was a guy who was going to – I mean, he could knock you out. Don't get me wrong. But it was like one of those things where he like went on points versus knockouts, and that would kind of – you know, Evander Holyfield was kind of a – yeah, he was a cruiserweight. In the words of cruiserweights, I believe, were 205. I believe heavyweight is above 225. Gained weight to then go fight in the heavyweight division, et cetera, et cetera. But yeah, but no, I'll miss George Foreman. I always found him funny. I just a sweet old man. The movie made about his life is very, very interesting. It didn't do much at the box office, but it's on streaming if you want to watch that. Let's get into the wrestling talk. WWE have announced a major UK tour the same week as Forbidden Door in London. Unlike the current European tour with days off, this is everyday shows leading to the August 31st Clash in Paris pay-per-view show at the Defense Arena, which is an indoor rugby stadium that would hold probably 35,000 for the show. This is Dave Meltzer talking. They have SmackDown in Dublin on August 22nd, house shows on the 23rd in Liverpool and the 24th in Newcastle, the date of Forbidden Door in London. Raw on August 25th in Birmingham, house shows the 26th and 27th in Manchester and Leeds, and on the 28th in Cardiff. Rev Pro is also running shows on August 22nd and 23rd at the Crystal Palace in London. Then they move to France and then the WWE moves to France for August 29th, SmackDown in Lyon, and August 31st in Paris. running on Friday rather than the usual Saturday, and September 1st Raw, also at the Defense Arena in Paris. I say this only because, again, I was told that this is the type of stuff that's good for business. And I know it came from the point of view of the upstarts getting one on the big boys, but eventually the big boys punch back, and eventually, yeah, it's going to be seen as horrible and cruel of WWE to do this to AEW, but this is the game. This is the life we chose, right? This is Michael Corleone and I forget his name.
You wanted to be a soldier, right? I feel like it's a little bit of The Wire here too. Yeah, like you guys wanted to be soldiers. You guys wanted to be in the game.
Yes, you want to be in the game. This is the game that we're gonna play. Yeah.
I mean, on a personal level, just you know, it's like. Yeah, they're going to do that. I think AEW is at a point right now where it's fairly easy for WWE to kind of choke them a little bit at certain areas. And I don't see why they wouldn't at this juncture. There's no reason to play nice.
I agree.
Nice for the good vibes on the internet, because those people you can always rely on.
In my heart, I am with everybody who goes, "What? That's just mean." You know, that's my first notion. Is they don't have to do this. It's nice to have a thriving industry at times. And yes, you don't want them to become your equals necessarily. I get that thinking too, but I don't think AEW is ever going to get to that point.
I think their issue was some of that big talk in the early days.
Yes.
You know, you talk big.
You never forget that. You never let go of those grudges.
Yes. Right. No, I mean, it's one of those things. It's like, you might move on, but you'll always remember when that person said X about you.
Yes.
Or when they said this. And, you know, you sometimes people, when they are giving into the lesser angels, enjoy doing that "Where's your God now, Moses" moment.
Where's your Messiah now, eh?
Where's your wrestling business now, eh, Moses?
little Edward G. Robinson coming up with a snow game. This is petty and mean, and I don't know if it's gonna necessarily affect AEW. That's the other thing, is I think the fan bases are so completely like, look, for Forbidden Door, Zack Sabre Jr. will be brought in, and maybe
Ospreay. They have I guess what I would say also is, you know, they have enough people on this roster who are big names in the UK that I don't think they're going to have a Mondo issue drawing. No. I mean, if anything, the one thing that Will Ospreay does really help you with is UK attendance.
No, and, you know, you'll have a couple of WWE people incognito at the show asking about contracts probably or something to that effect. It's just the game. That's what it is. But I'll follow it up with this story. Lex Luger has requested permission to seek out Sting inducting him into the WWE Hall of Fame.
He's always had a hard time finding Sting.
Okay, I gotta let that one breathe for a little bit. But no, but as you know, he is still under contract with AEW, and while Tony has agreed in the past to let WWE borrow guys like Billy Gunn, they never get to mention AEW on television. I mean, they never, these deals are not reciprocated in kind, but I think there are things that AEW can ask for. There are a lot of people going, Tony should say no. It's like, okay, but then What do you get out of saying no? You piss
also
off Sting.
What if Sting wants to do it? Yeah, and now you're telling Sting no.
Yeah, it's one of those no-win situations, because in theory, you're correct. Tony should say no. Tony says, no, you work for me now. You can't do this. But it means a lot to Lex. And Lex and Sting are boys. And they've been boys throughout their career. And it's just like I am sure Tony wants something related to Owen Hart given to him. I mean, that would be the ask to me. Wouldn't be a talent exchange like TNA / Impact. And that never worked out quite well either. If you recall, I believe Dixie got Chris asked for somebody and then got Christian, and Christian didn't want to work TNA. This is one of those thorny things where the boys are all friends, but their bosses are not friends. And then this will end up pissing off the people that you want to stay friendly with. It's a no-win situation for AEW, in my opinion, on this one.
Yeah, I mean, I think the move, the way to win the game is to not play. So the move here, in my opinion, is if WWE wants Sting for an evening, what is it really doing to you? And versus what is making a stink about this do? I think at this point, the loss side for Tony Khan and AEW in letting Sting do a Hall of Fame appearance for WWE's fake Hall of Fame versus the benefits of doing it, which are just simply, you're not necessarily even going to get huge things from WWE, but if it keeps Sting happy, that's good. That's worth it. And yes, especially if you can be like, Sting, I'm doing you a solid here. I maybe frame it as like, hey, I'm going to do you a solid. Just get me back in the future.
But let me also remind you, they have just announced that they are trying to screw with your attendance on one of your pay-per-views. In fact, three of your pay-per-views this year. And they are not going to relent on that. They you have planned your pay-per-views
the
around
is,
holiday
weekends.
Well,
the question is, do you want to drag Sting, wrestling icon, right, into the middle of that pissing match?
Yes, and that's therein lies.
Me personally, if I cared about Sting, I would want to get Sting off the chessboard, make him happy, and then continue my fight as needed.
Yeah, I'm with you more or less. I'm like, you know what? Sting's not going to wrestle for us anymore. He is retired. He has said as such.
Yeah.
He's friends with Luger. I don't like those guys over there, but I'm just going to keep doing my thing. And you know what?
It's not like Sting is about to wrestle for WWE. You know what I mean? It's like Sting
I would
is
even
make
do this
speech.
I would even do this low key. I wouldn't even announce anything if I'm AEW. Like, yes, we are allowing Sting to go and go. Go ahead and go do it.
It happens that night. It becomes a headline the next day, and then nothing matters.
Right.
The following
week. Right. I would try and stay under the radar on this one, to be honest with you. But I don't know. See, I don't know what Tony's thinking here either. So. Because he wants the fight and he's getting it, so he may get petty. I mean, there and you know what?
That usually happens when you start the fight. You start getting it, and it's not going the way that you wanted it.
Yes, and then you start begging for mercy. Homicide Nelson Erazo did his retirement match on March 20th in Brooklyn for Outlaw Wrestling on his 48th birthday. He said it was due to a cyst on his brain that was getting worse. Homicide, you know, ROH staple, most known for the original LAX with Hernandez. Probably more your generation than mine. Any memories of that?
Yeah, I remember seeing Homicide and LAX and Hernandez on Lucha Underground on a regular basis.
Homicide, the work rate guy. Hernandez always just, I don't think I'd take that that throw of his.
Oh my God, dude. Hernandez, he also used to be on Stipulation too, like when I was doing the TNA reviews. He was doing TNA, and so we were talking about him on Stipulation as well. I've talked about Hernandez with a number of different people through the years, and the consensus opinion of all of us was always like, man, I would not feel comfortable taking any move that he does. Even that Superman he does over the ropes was terrifying as well. That would not be a fun thing to take.
Yes, that, oh God. Yeah, I'm thinking about this because it's one of those things where I always compare it to Drew McIntyre's somersault somersault dive over the ropes. And you don't really appreciate how much of a force that is until you see it live in a small building. Because like on WWE, everybody's big and, you know, everybody's kind of spread out and the ring is big. But watching that the first time in PWG, watching him do that, a guy who's 6'7", almost three bills, watching Hernandez do that, then watching like some 5'8", 160, 70-pound guy trying to be a base for that, no thank you.
Oh my God. It's like he never got a ton of vertical, all that stuff. Hernandez is a scary guy to watch work. He was definitely pretty far up there on the Jeff Hardy potato spectrum.
Yes. I didn't want to turn this into necessarily a Hernandez burial talking about homicides, because there was, I mean, I've seen,
I liked Homicide. Homicide had some good matches
in Ring of Honor, especially when he was working with, you know, the smaller guys and stuff.
No, he was a good promo too. I actually thought he fit in pretty well into that Lucha Underground universe. Like, he got what they were trying to do there and was like,
yeah,
enjoying it. So
the character-y aspects of Lucha Underground, he seemed to really enjoy.
Yeah, he lended himself to that, and then that also lent themselves to the hardcore stuff that they like to do over there too. So I think Homicide, a good underrated wrestler, had a nice run.
And we'll end with this. On April 20th, after WrestleMania, comedian Tony Hinchcliffe will be doing a roast after WrestleMania. This was Hinchcliffe's idea rather than a WWE idea. Sami Zayn, Miz, Paul Heyman, and Braun Strowman all announced for it. Tony Hinchcliffe, famously comedian who performed at the Trump rally in Madison Square Garden, in which he called Puerto Rico an island of garbage. I assume that means Zelina Vega will not be on the dais for this one. I assume there will be some Kill Tony.
I'm amazed that Sami Zayn is making an appearance on this one.
Zayn runs in comedy circles. He's been doing the comedy things at certain pay-per-view two-day weekends for a while now. He has his own. It's kind of a hybrid improv stand-up show. Kathy Kelly, Miz, Braun, those types who like doing that kind of thing. It's not exactly improv, but it's not exactly stand-up type thing. It's kind of a variety show type of thing. So I'm not that surprised. I have in my history, how am I going to put this? Because I got to be careful a little bit. I don't fault the Kill Tony guys for the hustle. A lot of those guys were guys on my second run, were the guys who were always hanging out at the Comedy Store, working the door, kind of the gatekeepers for open mic night, very tight with Joe Rogan. And I was somewhat in the circle of Doug Stanhope still. But I assume some of these guys, like we saw the Schultz kid, is it Andrew Schultz, or am I mixing him up with the other Schultz? No, that's Andrew Schultz. He was on the, he was the guy who was taken out of the crowd by Logan Paul. I assume maybe Bert Kreischer is in there. Maybe some of the lower rung guys, and those would be the guys that I, like Sam Tripoli, Ari Shaffir, who, I'm going to have to take the Thumper's mom tact on Ari Shaffir. I have a story involving, I was featuring for Mike Birbiglia on a pretty big night, and Ari Shaffir was on the card, and Ari Shaffir likes to do the Andy Kaufman, see how many people I can piss off in the audience to make the other comics laugh type of a thing. And I really did not appreciate it because there was industry that night and they left for my portion of it and came back for Birbiglia. And I had the best night of one of the best nights of my life in stand up that night, which just makes me angry. There's some other guys like Ian Edwards. Yeah. The one funny Jamaican. He's a nice guy. But I assume it will be that branch of roast comics versus, say, the super professionals like Anthony Jeselnik. And I assume like a guy like Hulk Hogan will not be on the dais because he famously did a Comedy Central roast where he was very, very butthurt by the end of the night, according to friends of mine who wrote for that roast, because he is a guy who can dish it out but can't take it. And everybody was going after his baldness that night, and he was legitimately getting upset. It would seem to me a lot of the guys involved in the higher-up of WWE would not want to be involved in a roast because of things that might be said about the company slash Vince McMahon. I just don't think wrestling is a good avenue for a roast. And I will also say I was involved in writing jokes for that first Ric Flair roast that got canceled when he had the heart attack. I was hired to write originally for Eric Bischoff, and then Bischoff ducked out, and so I went to another participant at that time who then asked me why my jokes were so mean. And I'm like, and I'm a very good roast comic joke writer, but I also, I don't necessarily enjoy being on roast because I do, the way I developed my sense of humor was as a defense mechanism for people being mean towards me. So when people are mean towards me on a thing, my thing is to kind of step over that line. And I've had to learn, like, I've killed at roast, but I've also had to learn, hey, we're still supposed to like each other after the roast.
Yeah, right.
You can't go too far on that, Hawkins. And that is a fault of mine. I'm sorry to monologue a bit there, Chris.
No, I will just kind of pick up on that last point there, where it's like, I have also learned, because a lot of my sense of humor and jokes and stuff come from, you know, like, defense and, you know, being bullied and that sort of thing.
Yes.
I have to be very careful when I get into a defensive zinger mode, because they can be very, very potent, very funny, and also things that I kind of wish hadn't come out, even though they were really funny. I wish I had, I'll say things that go, God, I wish I had just thought that to myself. Damn.
Yes.
Yeah.
It was hilarious, and it's like one of those things.
It's really,
like,
true, and it's a good roast, but boy, I should have just thought that to myself.
Like, I don't like being publicly humiliated. That is a thing where I will remember that. You know, much like we were talking about, hey, you remember when you said this certain thing about someone in the midst of a wrestling war and they now remember it? That's me in terms of public humiliation, and it's happened to me a couple times, especially when I was younger, and I've actually never really gotten over it, to be honest with you. I can be like that at times. So it's one of those things where, yeah, it's funny, and it got a laugh from everybody, but it wasn't the right kind of laugh. It was that, yeah, you suck laugh, as opposed to, haha, we're all in on the joke laugh. And wrestling is, yeah, wrestling, it's like one of those things where it's like, it's already people are in a defensive position. And I think, I assume Hinchcliffe, or if Ari Shaffir is on this dais, they're not going to have another roast after this. This is going to be it. And this isn't being broadcast, I don't think. I think this is just for people in the room. And I think there's a good reason.
Oh, God.
I think there's a good reason for that as well.
Yeah, there might be a little bit of distrust of how the Hinchcliffe parts of this are going to go.
Oh, I'll give you a little behind-the-scenes stuff, too. There was originally, I think there was a podcast that lasted for like 3 or 4 episodes by a guy by the name of Saint Germain is how you say it, but it's like,
yeah, Saint Germain.
And he did the Flair roast, I think. He did a couple other related roasts or something. And he was, yeah, I'm just going to turn this into a podcast. And he reached out to the flagship and us to come on and promote it. And then he wouldn't do a quid pro quo. So I said, no, thanks. He go, oh, but I can give you visibility for your show. I go, I'm fine. Don't need it. Can I be part of your roast?
Oh, visibility.
Yeah, I'm like, dude, I'm doing good numbers at this point. Don't need you. But that'll end our news section. Now for the lazy river of wrestling criticism. I guess I'm in a monologuing mood today, Chris, and I apologize for that. Because I want to talk heroes and villains and other things of that nature, because...
We're picking up with John Cena, then.
John Cena and John Moxley both had... I don't know how to put this. I'm peaking for some reason. I just noticed that, so I'll apologize for any audio in advance. But
he's peaking when we're talking about John Cena, and you can't see him.
I certainly did not care for the tact that they went with on his on his promo. I liked the delivery. It felt like it was over workshopped or under workshopped. I can't tell which right now. What do you think?
I go back and forth. It's like turning Cena against the fans. I feel like someone in the writer's room was like, well, if John Cena's a heel now, then his greatest ally needs to now be his greatest enemy. And who is that? The fans. So it needs to be this, he turns his back on the fans thing in this very overt way. And I don't, to me, if you really don't care about the fans, if you're really turning your back on the fans, it's like in the same way of Miles Davis turning his back on the audience and just playing to the band. You don't care about them anymore. It's not even about courting boos. It's should just be about there and not getting anything to register from them at all. Like you're not regarding them. It would almost be more jarring for John Cena to come out there and not care about them at all. Not be addressing them, just continuing. He has a mission. He's doing what he's doing, and he doesn't even recognize them. He doesn't see them.
Yes. Well, that was good. The redemption, because you have to assume, because this is a retirement run, has to be in the flaw. And to me, it's right there. He wants to usurp Flair's number of title wins. And he wants to do anything he can to get there. That will be his legacy. That is his goodbye to the fans. And I don't know. I think that a lot of this, especially because we're having issues in just general pop culture, writing heroes and villains, it's all, you know, it's downstream from culture a bit. Because like towards the late 80s, like the hardest thing to write is a hero, because outside of the tragic backstory of how the person became a hero, heroes are kind of boring. And, you know, in the 50s and 60s, when we were still kind of optimistic as a society and, you know, idealistic and put, you know, that post-war boom, straight ahead heroes on serials and comics and whatnot, you know, truth, justice, the American way, always do what's right, always defend the weak, always do that. But they're boring. And so villains are a reflection of some sort of, they're the
villains are what make heroes interesting, right?
Yes.
Batman in and of himself is not interesting. It's the interaction of Batman and the Joker. It's
and
the
his
hero
rogues gallery. Yes.
Yeah. It's the hero villain relationship between those two guys that is inherently interesting.
Yes.
So hero writing is problematic sometimes. In that
Batman
sense.
Has a code. The Joker is anarchic. Batman, you know, still has faith in the justice system. Two-Face, because he was a product of the justice system and was failed by it. Now, you know, now decides that everything's chance or whatever. You know, Lex Luthor wants to be a god and wants power and wants that. And Superman is a god-level figure with enormous power who chooses not to use it. They're all kind of a flawed reasoning of the hero over here. And then towards the late 80s and early 90s, we started to get into we overcorrected. It's when like the Punisher and, you know, heroes who kill villains became very, very cool as a narrative structure, you know, taking justice into your own hands type of a thing. And, you know, everybody started rooting for the bad guys. We had, you know, and we had, you know, heroes of questionable morality in action movies and whatnot, just going around, you know, you kill everybody and then you go home. And then towards the mid 90s is when we started to get really into, okay, we don't want to overcorrect, but we want to go back to the hero method, but they need to be anti-heroes. They need to be people that we used to have faith in, but now we no longer do. And this was, I mean, it went from, you can watch the evolution from Oz, which was born out of Homicide: Life on the Streets, which was all about cops. and now we have The Prisoners, and how do they handle that, to then The Sopranos, which was basically the pitch for The Sopranos was, here's a guy who's in two families, and they both drive him crazy type of a thing, but we were never supposed to root necessarily for Tony Soprano. We were supposed to kind of empathize with him, and that born like the Vic Mackey of The Shield and Walter White in Breaking Bad. And now we have a problem where we can't have heroes without noticeable flaws. And we can't have villains because villains aren't bad anymore. Villains now have to have some nobility to them in some ways, or to be cool and wisecracking so they become cult figures of sorts, and then we can make them good guys again. John Cena's fairly straightforward to me. And I hate this reasoning of it was the fans who failed me. That's
no,
like...
no, I absolutely hate it. To pick up here real quickly, for me, it's like, no. For me, it's like the story here should be Cody and The Rock, in which John Cena is an adjunct. The Rock
is a pawn.
He's a pawn. The Rock is paying all of these people, not just John Cena, but also Kevin Owens and other Seth Rollins. The Rock should be trying to pour poison into all of Cody's friends' ears to get this belt off of Cody. The Rock should basically be always making these devil's deals with people.
Yes.
And John Cena should be the most shocking reveal of who took the devil's deal. Why, John, why? And it should only, he should never actually tell us, I'm doing this to beat Flair's record. He should explain that in the course of events when talking to other wrestlers. I don't want John Cena talking to me right now. The redemption arc you're talking about, the end of the story, the exit is the entrance, is when John Cena finally starts hearing the fans again and finally starts speaking to the fans again. But heel John Cena, he should not give a shit at all about them. No eye contact, no armbands. It's not about the music. This whole, like, even he's like, I'm not changing my music, I'm not changing my outfit. One, he should do both of those things. Two, he actually shouldn't even be telling them anything. The only good line in there is, that's my voice on the recording, why the hell would I change that? I actually liked that line a lot, but like, everything
I'm
else.
I'm not a baby face. I'm not a heel.
I hated that.
I hated that.
I hated that. I wrote it on, you know, to you. It's watching a crime drama where an actor all of a sudden announces, I am not a detective and I am not a gangbanger. I am not the leader of the Maloney gang. I'm an actor. My name is Floyd Jacobs. Like, what does that do for me? Where do we go from there?
Well, it's also permeated a bit in both. I'll try and get this into the Moxley story, but if you watched the promo last night on SmackDown between Punk, Roman, and Seth, Seth's part of it. Because CM Punk is bad for this business type of a thing, and it's like, no.
That would make so much more sense, though, if that was being ceded to him by Rock. That Rock is also out to get Punk. That, like, Rock essentially has his list of enemies, and he's assembling people in service of that list of enemies, of which Cody and Punk are on it.
I don't know, though, because it's one of those things where I don't want to talk about the wrestling industry within a wrestling feud. You know, it's kind of like somebody
saying, but this moves the focus away from Bloodline 5.0.
Yeah, but it's also like a football team going, oh, that team that runs the ball, they're bad for football. We need to eliminate them. Kind of a thing.
I think even inside of the company, they know that they can't keep Mania angling the Bloodline versus Cody Rhodes.
Yeah.
So I get it. You don't stop selling these t-shirts tomorrow and put them all on clearance. I'm just saying we need to have a new point of narrative focus, and The Rock as the final boss, both as a boss, basically kind of on a power trip from Mania to Mania, kind of coming in and out of the scene, but also being the overarching figure, is a place to pivot this to.
Right, and now I'm going to bring it into the Moxley-Cope feud from AEW. Because the narrative here, to me, it misses the point of doing stipulations. When you have a feud and a good guy decides that the company needs a stipulation. It's to, and we talked about this last week, I believe. It's to trap the bad guy into no longer being able to use his bag of tricks against the good guy. And hey, he's finally going to get his comeuppance. I'm proposing a cage match so that I'm finally, there, you know, in a cage and nobody can stop me from beating him up. When a heel decides that he's going to put a stipulation, he has a plan in mind. And it is then up to the babyface to then figure out what this heel has going on and to enter in some sort of plan, which is why I am desperately hoping that Dax turning on Cope, or at least teasing it, is because Cope did something stupid. Because the whole point, because people are going, well, why are Mox and Cope running it back next week in a no DQ walk-in brawl or whatever thing? And everybody was like, well, because they were unhappy with the match at the pay-per-view. No, in story, it's that Mox said, oh, you're going to use the rules as an excuse. Fine, we don't need the rules. And you won't have them. And then Cope should then go, okay, why is he not wanting the rules? Oh, because he's going to have a cast of thousands, which happened, come out and try and interfere and do all this stuff. No, no, no. I'm going to overcome 6-on-1 to then finally win this title, et cetera, as opposed to saying, hey, I need guys to watch my back so that this is an actual 1-on-1 type of match. We've lost the plot because we just wanted to have the rematch as opposed to letting it make narrative sense as to what, how Cope is fighting this match in there. And there needs to be that second level thinking. And there just wasn't on this. I enjoyed the match other than the spot.
Yeah. The spot, but no, I'm with you on the build here. Right. I think this is a really lovely example of where having some enhanced storytelling would make this much more interesting. Essentially, Moxley outsmarts Copeland. Copeland gets blinded by rage and blinded by vengeance and a need to get this title, and he's pissed off about Christian. He's pissed off that Christian screwed him over, but he's not. Most importantly, he's emotionally dysregulated at this point. He's not in control of his emotions. He wants vengeance on Christian. He wants vengeance on Moxley. And Moxley tricks him. Okay, you can have your rematch. You can have your vengeance. Let's get rid of the rules, baby. Let's just throw them all out. And Cope walks right into it.
Yes.
And my problem with the match, other than the spot, and I guess we'll talk about that here in a second, it was also the help deployment. Either have all of Copeland's help jumped backstage, and then they come in for the late save, or have Copeland's help come out early at the same time, basically, as the Death Riders. They should not just be sitting backstage perfectly healthy, but not coming out in a no disqualification match once the Death Riders show up.
I have the feeling that this is going to be the too clever by half reasoning by which we get, all right, Dax is going to be angry at Cope and Cash is going to be morally conflicted, but eventually side with Dax against Cope. And then the patriarchy's turning on Christian. And so they are two guys who no longer have anybody backing their play, and they find each other. And that's how we get to Cope and Christian versus FTR.
Yeah.
And then we have Kip Sabian and Nick Wayne, who can take falls for both of them in the build for that. That's what I'm thinking. And then it just, to me, that kind of makes no sense. But
oh, I know the idea of
turning.
I mean, it. There is like loose horse sense to it, but with the way you've presented Christian the entire run of the company, the idea that you can just turn him tomorrow and everyone's gonna love him.
Go F yourself.
They might.
They might. Yeah.
It for me as a fan of story drives me a bit batty.
Yes.
Like I need that Christian redemption thing.
Yeah, and just to put a put a bow on this. I'm sort of agreeing, other than the Cody story, none of these Mania stories are getting me. Just, I know we have a month to go, but man, and all the problems to me are just in a microcosm of this Charlotte Tiffany Stratton feud, which is just Tiffany's not really a babyface, and Charlotte's doing a very good Britt Baker act, and I mean that in the sense of burying Tiffany on the mic, in terms of I mean, we're talking about each other's looks and other things like that, and you're just like, I'm a flair. I'm better than you. I'm the new Charlotte type of a thing. It's not getting, although I do like the Io Rhea Bianca feud. I'm starting to get into that a little bit more.
Yeah, I'm getting there. Jade and Naomi still kind of does nothing for me. That side of it
still makes no sense to me.
It makes no sense. Jade just doesn't work.
Jade should be the heel.
I know. Jade just doesn't work.
No.
I'm trying to see what else on Raw I thought was...
Gunther and Jay?
Gunther and
working
Jay?
Working for you? I mean, Gunther's good in it. It's just the feud isn't...
No, because, I mean, Jay Uso... A lot of the main event Jey Uso character is hinged in the heat level of the bloodline.
Yes.
You know, it's, you can take the Uso out of the bloodline, but you can't take the bloodline out of the Uso when it comes to presentation here.
Yeah, and they're a little bit lost because they, you know, it's one of those things where they're trying to build the split, I think, between Solo and Jacob Fatu, but Jacob Fatu is such a runaway star of this act right now, and they can't figure out where to put him for Mania necessarily.
Yeah. And then like Seth Rollins's character right now is a mess. And this is why I was bringing up the Rock thing. For me, the Rock suggestion of he's just buying off Cody's former friends helps clean up a lot of these storylines. Rather than like Seth Rollins giving you a complicated Rube Goldberg machine and a history lesson to explain why he's doing anything.
Yeah, it avoids the actual history that they need for this story, which is CM Punk originally wanted to bring in the Shield, which was Moxley, Ambrose, Ambrose, yeah. Rollins, but it was originally Chris Hero, and then he was replaced by Roman Reigns, but in story in kayfabe, he brought in the Shield to protect him, et cetera, and they eventually turned on him, et cetera, but to me, number one, I like the idea of The Rock having made offers to multiple people in the Elimination Chamber. And playing up that story would have helped all of this. And Seth has secretly taken the deal, and it's going to be revealed too. But again, Seth Rollins' entire angle with CM Punk and now Roman Reigns is about corporate fealty. And I'm the most loyal employee of the WWE.
It's three guys fighting over who is the best soldier for this company.
Who's the best executive vice president to get the corner office? And that just doesn't interest me at all, as opposed to actual...
stakes? You know, Roman Reigns is fighting because he wants to become championship relevant again. Seth Rollins is fighting because he feels like, despite still stacking up wins... For some reason or another, he's dropping down in the contendership list, and he feels like he's got to do something to shake it up. CM Punk sees his clock ticking. And so, I mean, really, this match would just be so much better as the number one contendership for whoever is champion coming out of Mania.
Yes. And all of them want the title. And
all of them want the title. All of them have a plausible road to it. All of them are top-level competitors. And it would be so much better than, like, well, I love this company. No, I love this company.
Yes.
I love my boss.
I love coming into work every day and putting it all out there for the fans. It's just like,
we have a tremendous start time to our shift.
But I will caveat this. I like Punk's reasoning is that I just want to be the guy who headlined WrestleMania. I think that's good enough without going over the line of, oh, Triple H and Vince like me the best kind of a thing. You know, I just want to headline WrestleMania. That's all I want. That's my goal, is to headline a WrestleMania before I retire.
And if you want to weave this together back into the Rock story, a lot of fun way of doing this would be Rollins has taken the deal with the devil. Punk has said hell no. And Roman Reigns is a giant question mark to even Paul Heyman.
Yeah, and instead we're getting Heyman's the question mark, which I just...
It would be so much better if Heyman is like actually kind of confused and flummoxed over what Roman's plans are.
Right. He hasn't been told anything by his tribal chief. I'm just out here right now. I have no idea. And again, another thing that would help Seth so much in this is to get rid of the shopping in the women's section and it all being all about the song and listening to people chant his song, because none of that has anything to do with his motivation right now, unless it's just I do wrestling because I want to hear people sing a song to me and I want to know that I'm over, which isn't much of a storyline.
It's actually how I drifted mentally to Rick Martel for Vader Club this week, is I had this weird epiphany that Seth Rollins is doing like a less coherent Rick Martel with the dressing, and like he's clearly up his own ass, but it's not necessarily as overtly stated as like Rick Martel's model character.
Got it. I've monologued enough. Go ahead and go where you want to go.
Okay. I guess let's take it over to NXT. We are trying to do something with Trick Williams here. We are trying to heat him back up as a heavy striker to build us back up to Obafemi. I have two problems with this. One, I am not particularly interested in seeing Trick Williams and Obafemi have another match with one another. They never really lit my world on fire in any of their prior matches. Oba's had that nice outing with Moose, but I'm still very much of the opinion that Obafemi is someone who needs to have a good guy to have a good match. And Trick Williams, okay, we're rebranding him as his striker. We're doing this by absolutely cannibalizing the push of Eddie Thorpe.
Yes.
And I don't really get it, because we've done everything we need to do for Trick Williams. Eddie Thorpe, maybe you think he's a main event guy, maybe you don't. I'll be honest. The jury's out for me. Like I maybe he can have better long form matches. Like I'm not saying it's not out of the realm of possibility, but you have to clear the lane to make some space for Eddie Thorpe to do that. And having Trick Williams have his umpteenth title match to try to get this guy more hot than what he is, which is a 4 out of 5 at all times at absolute maximum.
I have a strong feeling that what are they called? What's this Timu Nexus called? I want to say Blackgate, but it's not Blackgate. It's
They do have masks.
Well, they've taken off the masks now.
They did take off the masks. Yeah, but they had masks. And I guess they're not with Ricky Starks.
No, but I'm thinking it's going to end up being either Trick or Ricky Starks that they're with.
Okay, and this is like Trick's new posse?
Yes.
Okay.
It feels like that this is the new, how we're going to freshen him up and build him back up, as he's going to be the leader of a faction type of a thing.
I mean, okay. It would be interesting to at least see if he could do the faction leader thing. I think you could probably squeeze one more cup of lemonade out of this lemon. He is like, you know, Adam Cole type character, heel champion, and Obafemi is trying to get his title back and destroying everyone in its way on the way to getting his title back. I think that actually would be good for both of them, potentially, if Trick Williams can carry the leader thing. I just still don't think he's a charismatic guy. I think he's
– I agree.
Actually, he's burdened with having a goofy name where you almost have to have a, like some charisma. Like if you're going to be named Orange, you have to have some sort of charisma about you.
Yeah, his name's not like Jimmy Trick Williams. It's Trick Williams.
Yeah, right.
And he has a chant and everything, and he's not – I mean, he has charisma, but he doesn't have –
Like, if I started going by snake bite, right, you can't be, like, three-quarters of the way there. You got to be all the way snake bite. You know what I mean? Like, don't mess with snake bite. And I come in, I'm like, I'm snake bite. We're going to do
you're
some
wearing, cross- you're wearing a sweater vest over the motorcycle cut.
Yeah, we're going to – all right. I want you guys to go out there and you get the drugs and you sell it for the money. Because I'm Snakebite. I don't take any business.
Snakebite says the motorcycle club has to go more into civic engagement, so we're building a playground for the kids. What?
I want a no-nonsense approach to cleaning up this trash on the side of the road.
Yeah. NXT was intriguing, because there's stuff I like, and there's stuff that I just go, huh, that's what they're doing. And the huh, that's what they're doing is mostly this week for me. Ricky Starks and Ridge Holland. I don't know what they're doing with either of these guys.
I mean, me neither. I found myself... Because... That was a baffling match.
Because Ridge Holland is a power guy who they heated up to a hot level and then absolutely threw into an ice bath and didn't bring up, and now that he's sticking around and they have to figure out something to do with him. Ricky Starks is a small, quick guy that they're giving, I guess, a main event. Let's see if he can work WWE main event style. So he has to do power moves against Ridge Holland.
Oh, that slam. God.
The Rochambeau wasn't good on Ridge Holland.
That twisting gut wrench was not.
Yes, that's what I was talking about. There you go.
Yeah, that twisting gut wrench. It wasn't, because the Rochambeau is like a leg move, right?
No, you're right. No, the Rochambeau's the pick him up and flip him over. Type of move, I thought, but
I don't know, but yeah, is that twisted gut wrench was a mess. I was actually amazed he was able to get Ridge Holland up. When I was watching it though, in my head, the first thing I thought was like, whoa, he's going for that. Jeez,
are they
like,
trying to expose his weaknesses? And imagine, I know, say, here's what you need to work on, kid, bulking up a little bit. It was just one of those things. I'm watching, I'm going, who does this serve right now? And it almost feels like Tony Khan level booking, where it's like, you two go out there and have a 3.5-4-star match, and then one of you will get a push or something like that. It's just like, I did not enjoy that at all. Your turn, sir.
I continue to like Inamura. I'm just ready for him to do some other stuff. I want to see Yoshiki Inamura do other things. He's good.
I like this team. I don't know. See, the characterization isn't there. It's they're two guys who are pretending to be motorcycle club members, I guess.
I would much rather Josh Briggs have a new friend from Japan who says almost nothing.
Yes.
And he's the only person who's actually friends with Briggs, and Briggs is the only person who's actually friends with him, and we almost never see them talk. Like,
exactly.
I would actually be very fun to see them have a warm, unspoken chemistry just backstage. Whenever we even, you know, we're backstage and Chelsea Green's kvetching about something. In the back, you see Inamura and Briggs, like, playing chess. Like, doing all these non-verbal things, but, like, obvious bonding activities constantly. Rather than this more sort of, like, over-the-top, like, well, like, you know, Yoshiki, you ride motorcycles with me or something. Like,
yes.
Let's do pickup truck things. Like, I don't need that. I think
we come into work, we kick ass, and then we go our separate ways, but while we're at work, we enjoy hanging out with each other.
Yeah, like you see, like, Briggs, like, showing, like, Inamura something on the CD player on Spotify or something like that, like, hey, check this out. And Inamura, you know, like, it would be, I think that's actually an easy story to tell, where you don't even have to do promos. You just keep having it be in the background of the show whenever you're backstage. And that's something that can be established and cemented in. Chelsea Green, I think, continues to do exceptional work. She's so, good. So good. I'm glad people are on. I know you've always been there, but like more and more people are seeing the genius of Chelsea Green. She is funny. She is talented. She is a very good wrestler.
Her entire crew are funny and talented. That's yes. The other thing is that both Piper and Kaylee Ray are really, really good. And that helps against someone who is still trying to figure it all out, like Sol Ruka. But yeah, I mean, and she is doing the job. I'm loving the Green Regime. I love that as a name. Her branding continues to get more and more ridiculous as the United States champion. And as it does, she gets more and more over, which I like, because we're now heightening the bit more and more.
I think in particular, she's doing this in a way that wherever you sit with the current news climate, I feel like you can just enjoy this act. It's funny.
Yes. It's nonpartisan, but it's there because it's in the news type of a thing. It's really, really good.
No, she's really good. I wish I could say the same thing about Carmen Petrovic and JC Jane. I just feel like Carmen Petrovic is. I wanted that
match to be so much better than it was.
Me too. And I see something there with Petrovic and like JC Jane. Like this should have been the pairing that kind of got it going. And this match,
JC's really good. Fatal Influence is a bad gimmick. It's because you don't believe the chemistry between JC and
they don't have the toxic attraction chemistry. Right. Like JC, Gigi, and was it Trish originally?
No. It was Mandy.
Mandy. That's Mandy. Yeah. Yes. JC. I mean, that actually felt like chemistry.
Like if it was just JC and the cowgirl.
Fallon.
Fallon, it'd be fine.
A little bit country, Jasmine.
Jasmine, I don't believe. A little bit of rock and roll. Go ahead. Yeah.
Yes. Nyx in particular, though, is, I mean, like right now they have like sort of a Spice Girls minus two thing going on where you got the country one, the rock and roll one, and then
Village People minus two.
Yeah. Sports one. You have sporty Fatal. Jasmine Nyx. But I mean, she just doesn't have any personality, and the three of them do not have distinguishing personalities between one another. They occasionally will like butt heads over this, that, or the third, but outside of that, and like Carmen, they don't really have personalities.
Carmen's entire gimmick stinks now with this Ashante the Adonis love story because he's such a dope. And her what brought her to the dance was kicks. And her kicks are sharp because she's a karate person. And instead, this was, like, they do this with certain athletes where it's like, we want to show that you're a well-rounded wrestler after you have a good match, because she had a good match last week. And so we're going to concentrate on the things you're weak on in this match, which is the tumbling and the grappling, instead of the kicks, which is what got her to the dance.
Well,
it's like Kalani Jordan gymnastics.
Stop like focusing on too many things in one match, too. If you're going to start this stupid Ashante the Adonis gimmick, then the focus of the match is not about fundamentals anymore. Now it's about character work with Ashante the Adonis and Carmen Petrovic. What is their chemistry? How does this relationship work? Does he help her win matches? Does he hurt her chances of winning matches? These are the things that need to be established.
And the final thing I have for NXT before we haven't talked about the spot yet, so we have to talk about the spot. But I like Jada Parker a lot. I like her intensity on promos. I like that she feels real on promos. I just don't know if I'm supposed to root for her or not like her because she's angry all the time.
Right? Is it baby face work because she's sassy and got attitude? Or is it heel work because she's cocky
a rage person, yeah,
and angry? It straddles this very weird line. In a way, you can nod to the fact that she's kind of found the elusive tweener character in a very authentic way, where like this character could at any point go face or heel on you because she's only in it for herself.
But then they put her against faces and heels.
Right.
Like, consecutively. Right. And you're just kind of like, she's just angry. She's just a miserable human being.
And my other thing is whenever they go babyface with her, they turn it into a tearjerker. And I think yes. If you're going to do this character, there's never any tears. It's never any simpy, to quote Scott Steiner here. You have to actually just basically be like, I'm going to beat the shit out of Roxanne Perez or whoever she's up against. And that's enough, like, where we're all like, ooh, Roxanne's going to finally get hers. Like, Jada Parker needs to be that, like, sort of heel that even the heels are afraid of. They're all intimidated by her.
Or it feels like, and you can pull me back on this one because I don't know if I'm phrasing it in a way that's offensive, and I hope I'm not. But there's a very middle-aged white guy writing urban wrestler type of vibe there, where it's kind of like they're going too heavy into a bit of a stereotype.
Yeah, there's a lot of sass. We're going real heavy on sass.
Okay, so I'm not over the line saying.
No, I think that like we have used sass in place of real characterization. That said, I do think with some tweaking and fine tuning, the Parker character could really work as this in between character that has a way of reacting dynamically to whatever situation. And thus also is an immediate insertion into any three-way feud you want, right? She doesn't have a problem having a feud with a babyface or a heel. I think there is a place for that in this division. And she's, you know, she's also the right size for that too. You know, like this type of tweener character wouldn't work if she was the size of Roxanne Perez, but right. Jada Parker at the size that she's at is actually kind of perfectly built too, to occupy that. You know, sometimes I'm good, sometimes I'm bad. But sometimes you think I'm good, sometimes you think I'm bad, but I'm actually always just me. And that's your problem, is I'm just in it for myself, and sometimes you like what I'm in it for, and other times you don't.
Yeah, that's a tough character to write for. Because especially...
Well, especially if you're stuck with working with, you know, tired stereotypes.
Yes.
But I think it is possible with Parker and her attitude. That's all I'm saying.
I agree with you. It's just you need to tell the crowd.
You know, you have to kind of hit a little bit of a reset button. I mean, I would, after she kind of wraps this up, even maybe, because it's not like any real damage has been done at this point, just step it back and then kind of reassess how we want to present her to kind of land right down the lane here. And I just have, you know, Jada Parker out there just kicking ass.
Like when when Kehlani finally snaps, because she's still towing that line, Jada should be unmoved by this and still want to kick her ass.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. No, there's a place for her. I like Jada a lot. I also think she's a good promo too.
She's a great promo.
She's charismatic, man. This NXT show, as you said, I just find it's all over the place. The universe has struggles in the same way as AEW's universe has struggles. But like, you know, I will definitely say one thing AEW is running circles on is at least right now they're not doing the GM character. And I feel like Ava continues to be an active negative on this show.
The goofy character, while a nice hook, is becoming a detriment to a lot of people. This culling family feud, I have no interest in. The problem with AEW is they're painting themselves into corners on their booking, and then everybody's kind of forgiving it because at least the matches will be good. Like, to me, you don't need, with 2 weeks to go, a three-way for the Kenny Omega Invitational. Because you ran a tournament to get into a four-way, and then you had a double pin. So why not just have the two guys wrestle, and then you can do consecutive pay-per-views with the two of them and figure it out? But instead, we had to do this contrived double pin, and then, you know, instead of having playing up the situation as real with, you know, hey, we need to converse and decide how to decide. No, Justin Roberts already has the situation well in hand and announces that both people pinned Mark Davis or whoever in that match. It's just like,
yeah, they both pinned Mark Davis. When I was looking at this finish, my thought was, man, what's Kenny Omega's overall health sitting at right now? Because to me, putting Speedball and Ricochet in there and shoehorning them into this match that hard, getting both of them in rather just one or the other, suggests to me that maybe there's some concern about Omega.
So he gets to take a rest during the match while the other team fight?
Yeah, he gets right. Okay. Yeah, he needs. Yeah.
I could see that. I just, it's, I don't like three ways for titles personally. It's
no,
just
me neither.
All right. I don't think I have anything. Oh, and then running back Chris Statlander and Megan Bain again, 4 weeks after that, just because we're trying to get to Tony Storm and Megan Bain. I would have saved it. I mean, I don't.
This was the wrong type of match too. Like, especially for the Tony Storm universe, right? I feel like at this point, everything's got to be like a movie. And
yes,
what I mean by that is Megan Bain should be coming in there like Bane from Batman or Frankenstein's monster. And Tony Storm, like, we should almost get like a Rocky and Apollo Creed thing beforehand where Tony's meeting with Chris Statlander and Chris Statlander's like, I got to do this, champ. And after I beat her, I want a shot at the title. And Tony's like, there's nothing I'd like more than that. You know, like really dramatic stuff, really play it up. You know, I just think if you're going to stick with this ham character, then it's got to be real hammy. It's got to be real cinematic. It's got to be real goofy. And that's how all these builds have to be until you get to the actual match and then they can have a real match. But like the Storm Universe doesn't, going back to Snakebite, Storm Universe does not work if you're only half committed to the bit. You have to be Snakebite.
Yeah, there's a dual problem here. Number one, they wanted to keep Statlander hot, even though she's lost to Bane, and I don't think there's money in Statlander. I think that time has passed, sort of. And then, so they're playing up this, well, she used some shortcuts to get, okay, that doesn't work. She still lost.
No, and that doesn't help build a big, ferocious monster to Tony Storm.
The other thing, and to me, this is a much larger problem, and it's one that's going to continue to be around. The money in the division to me, while the love of the division is Tony Storm, Mercedes should be almost the focal point of this company. She was fantastic in that match with Billy Starks. She's now in her own universe with this TBS title over here. And it's almost like a Tony's listening to the fans who don't want to push the WWE star over the quote-unquote homegrown star of Tony Storm. And they have to continue to paint themselves in corners to say that, yes, these are two separate universes that you should not care about, so to speak.
Mm-hmm. I thought Mercedes and Billy Starks had an excellent match. Billy Starks looked really poised. Mercedes, of course, helped her get there. Yes. And yeah, I thought it was, I was just really impressed. She's 19. She's doing a high profile show and she did not look the way some other talents have looked like on this show, really above their weight class.
Right.
Yes. Yeah, Starks looked newer, obviously, did not look as seasoned, obviously, but did not look like a deer in the headlights, to use kind of a tired.
Did not look like the moment was too big for her.
No. She very much seemed in there. Talk about the spot.
Talk about the spot.
Which spot?
The spike.
The Moxley. Yeah, we never did. Okay. So I think this spot was idiotic for any number of reasons. Now, you of course go, well, Chris, you never did any hardcore wrestling. No, I didn't. I did do a little
bit. You did? Wait, what?
No, I did some backyard wrestling with my teenage friends, of which I have lingering physical injuries from, including a separated shoulder. But no, I never did any actual professional wrestling, right? But you look at a spot, and you can sort of have some sense of safety. And I'm also, in addition to liking wrestling a lot, one of my other interests is in magic tricks and circus stuff. I just have always found this stuff fascinating. So, like, I'm well acquainted with the physics of the spike board, for example. Like, I understand how they do it. I've seen some pretty incredible acts on the spike board and all of that sort of thing. In all the times I've ever seen that particular act, have never seen anyone jump on to the spike board with their back. Because falling onto the spike board like that, you might be able to evenly distribute the weight and it's okay. But there's a very, very high likelihood, if you are off with your weight distribution, that the spike board is going to go in. And if it goes in into your spinal column, you could have a really big problem really, really quickly here. Stopped doing chair shots to the head on TV, largely, not all the time, obviously. But now it's considered, it is looked at eyes askance. It is not considered to be like a cool thing. It's more like, whoa, I'm predicting a chair shot. Okay. Like, we're not like, yeah, like we were when we watched The Undertaker. You just like concuss the shit out of somebody. Like, I'm
ECW 1995. You know, right. We're not doing, yeah.
Right. So we've moved on this, right? Because we determined that even though sometimes you might be able to do that in a somewhat safe way if the other guy is good at it, you know, blah, blah, blah. Any one time that might be able to be executed safely, but stretched out over 100 times, we know that there's a body count associated with that, if not literally, figuratively, in terms of concussions and that sort of thing. This is how I feel about watching somebody body slam someone else, not their full center of mass, mind you, but their full body onto a very small point in a spike. John Moxley is, in my estimations, when I watch that spot, extraordinarily lucky that none of those nails somehow ended up wedged into his back in a more meaningful way other than just surface level. I know you can dull the tips on these nails, and I hope they dulled them pretty good, but apparently they weren't that dull because they went in. So I thought this spot was idiotic. And if you're going to do a spot like this, the only reason to do this is for your main event feud at your show of the year. And they peppered this one into the middle of a not really important Dynamite.
Yes.
This to me, I think, is just sort of inexcusable. Spot meant nothing and is a horrible spot. It's a horrible idea to cede to people. This is not a good thing. Do not do this at home or ever.
And to piggyback on your point, the heel gets slammed on the spikes and then heroically overcomes it to then win the match. This should have been, and it's on broadcast television. So let's say you're a 14-year-old and your mom walks in at that point. I tell my kid you can't watch this stuff anymore. I understand that this pops the neckbeard crowd, and I get it, you know, or ECW fans from back in the day.
If I didn't grow up watching wrestling and I just came in and saw my 10-year-old watching this, and I was like, what the hell is that guy doing with a nail in his back?
This is a pay-per-view spot. This is not a weekly television build spot. And I was physically uncomfortable watching it, and I have a high threshold type thing.
You know, they're all folded.
Yes.
Yes. I mean, he was like, yes, it was gross. It was like he was making a burrito out of his skin on the back.
And this is CCW John Moxley coming back. And there's a reason why this stuff was saved for house shows during the territory days, and why Dusty Rhodes was fired from the NWA WCW for that spike spot when the Road Warriors jammed a spike into his eye. Okay, I understand, well, this is, you know, we've evolved as a people. Well, not necessarily. And I understand gore is now more part and parcel of our popular culture on basic cable and things of that nature, too. But it's just, to me, it's like, that's a spot that should be memorable.
Right.
For a memorable time and place. And on a weekly
my big
TV
thing
show,
is
an
like
hour
it's
two is
spot more. Inflation, right? Like,
yes, yes.
My big thing is less about the moral oraling
yes.
of this,
sorry.
And much more. No. I don't disagree with you on this. And obviously, my last comment had a little bit of like a. This is actually a bad influence on people.
Yes.
But then my other leg of this is simply spot inflation. At a certain point, nothing means nothing. Right. And, you know, if I can hit you with a spike bat in the middle of the match, and that's not the cause for you ultimately losing the match, that shit didn't matter.
Right. Right. We're quickly going into why not bring a gun to a no DQ match?
Yes. No, my old joke back on Lucha Underground about the gun circle match. Like you know, I was you put a gun in a circle and they wrestle until one of them gets the gun, and then you get a three count.
Somewhere Heyman's going, why didn't I think of that for Philadelphia 1999?
The Novembrino gun match is a classic.
Oh,
too many are they're so scared to do it, but I'll tell you, it's a banger. Get
well,
it? Get it?
What is it with my co-host making terrible jokes this week? Because Paul over on the Dynamite show talked about
that
Harley,
Sting joke the, earlier was a good joke. That
no,
was a
that
good
one,
Sting
that one,
joke.
That one was fine. It was Paul's on the Dynamite show about Harley Cameron and the Mordos angle, and she should call herself the Breast because she's trying to call herself because it's a breast joke. I'm just like, that's the worst
wait,
thing
wait,
I've
he
ever
gave
heard.
You, he gave you the explainer with the joke?
No, but
oh.
no. I was gonna say,
like, I'm sure you got what Breast was going at.
Yes, I got it. I just went, no, it's not good. And then he explained.
Oh, so he did give you an explainer.
I think he did. I'm trying to misremember. I'm trying to forget it, to be honest with you, because it's just a terrible joke.
Just blacking it out, huh?
I'm just, yes, I try that. It's what I do with bad jokes. I black them out and I move on, especially my own. Let's do Vader Club. You went into your AWA bag of tricks for Rick Martel versus Jumbo Tsaruta for the AWA title. This video on YouTube, very interesting because it starts with Tsaruta beating Bockwinkle for the title.
Yeah.
Gets to the match intros and then starts about 10 minutes in progress.
Yes.
Which I was like, oh, that's interesting.
I would like to see more of it, although the final 10 were great. And honestly, the match style for AWA back in these days, you know, if you miss.
Okay.
If it's 25 minute match and you miss the first 10, it's okay.
And you had some questions about Rick Martel that I think I'm going to be able to answer for you.
Yeah.
In some ways.
Let me ask you this then. So, like, the big question for me has always been. 1990s comes around. Rick Martel, still very good. He's still, you know, having good matches up to and including with Shawn Michaels and everything like that. And then pretty rapidly, he just gets completely de-pushed off of the card. And that's when he starts pursuing his real estate career for the first time. But you said you had some sort of reason to account for the de-push there in like 92-93?
I have some factors that could have been involved in it. I don't know for sure. Rick Martel is a very, like, Rick Martel always had his own thing going. And he had a transactional at best relationship with Vince McMahon. He goes back to WWF originally in the 80s to screw over the Crockett Cup, if you remember that, because he and Dino Bravo were supposed to be on a team in the original Crockett Cup, and Vince comes in and takes them both because they're not under contract. He had worked for Vince's dad as in a tag team with Tony Garea for a while. In the early 90s, though, he has he has the falling out with Tom Zink because Martel made his own deal and Zink was his protege and he kind of screwed Tom Zink a little bit on it. So this being, that's why Zink leaves. And then he eventually goes to Strikeforce. He has to take some time off in 92 or 93, I think, because his wife gets cancer. In 91, he's one of the people in that original George Zahorian trial that testified that Zahorian gave him steroids. And it was him, Spivey, B. Brian Blair, and Roddy Piper. And out of those, three of the four were eventually brought back by Vince. But in 93, 94, that's when the Zahorian gets put up to the federal level with Vince McMahon. And so it might be a combination of Vince just, and he's also given like lots of time off from time to time because he's going into real estate and he's doing that venture. So he's given plenty of time off. He's just kind of there to be a guy to put over young guys in the 90s,
yeah,
so to speak. Because he's doing programs with like Sparky Plug and Virgil when Virgil turns babyface. He's a guy that wasn't a corporate animal, but was there for the money kind of a thing. And he also just isn't a good promo in English. He's a native
Until he found the native or the model character.
The model character. But even then he has to do multiple takes of those promos. Those are, you know, filmed in advance promos. He's not doing those live per se because English is his second language and he was never necessarily strong with that. So he kind of just comes and goes. He's doing indie work at the same time in like the 93, 94 time. He's originally supposed to come back in 97 as the models with Don Callis, of all people, who he had been working a program with on the indies, and they were going to come in as a unit. And I kind of assume Martel was going to screw over Don Callis a little bit in that one, too, where he asked for more money and says, well, give Callis what you want. He's just happy to be here. He's my protege type of thing. I mean, Martel's still a worker at this point. You turned me on to this, and I watched a few more matches of this. That last run on Nitro, you know, in the Monday Night Wars, where he's kind of doing the work rate thing.
He's
still
good.
He's really good.
He's really good. Yeah. And that's why I picked the Saruta one, just to go a completely different angle. It's like he had a lot of matches with a lot of different people. A lot of people anyone who likes would like. And he has good matches with all of them. And that tells you quite a lot.
Yes, he's a very good worker. He was always the guy to me in my teens, because I didn't get the AWA until I was in my later teens, so to speak. So Bockwinkel wasn't my guy, but because of the wrestling magazines, and there was a very famous cover, you know, Hulk Hogan versus Ric Flair versus Rick Martel. You know, who would win that match? Because Hogan was the WWF's guy, and Flair was the archetype of the NWA, and Rick Martel, to me, always screamed, okay, he's the AWA champ, because he was the young, good-looking guy that they were going to push to the moon, et cetera, that I didn't know any better, and then eventually he gets to the WWF and stuff, and you go, I thought he should be a much bigger star than he was, but I didn't know about his lack of English skills. I knew, you know, he sounded kind of French to me. I just knew he was Canadian at the time, and I just assumed, you know, back in my teens that all Canadians spoke English.
I mean, he's not intractably bad, but certainly the thickness of the French accent was going to prohibit him from really doing anything as a baby face.
And from being a Vince guy.
Yeah, in that sense, yes. But then, like, to this point, going back to Martel rising above on another, he always rose above bad material, dude.
Yes.
It's like, so he is not a great speaker and he's not getting a lot of mic time. So he starts very much telling you the story visually in the outfits, like the feud with Tatanka. He's got the feather. The arrogance cologne, which is, hey, look, that was good. All of those things, he managed to get a character across He had the heel versus heel feud with Shawn Michaels, which is kind of uncommon at the time. And I think, you know, if he hadn't, maybe this coincides with the timeline too. If he hadn't had that absolute stinker of a Mania match with Jake the Snake Roberts, like if they had just had a better blow off at all, like if their blow off match was like a 3.5 star, that'd probably be, you know, like that would. That might have changed his trajectory.
The
blindfold thing was so bad.
Oh, it was terrible.
That was received poorly at the time, too.
But it was an easy night for them, too.
Yeah, well, obviously they both like that part. I mean, yes. Jake's not a body guy, not a hard work guy.
And Rick Martel, I'm here for the money. Thank you very much. You know, it's one of those things where it's like, I mean, you're looking at it from, well, he was a really good worker and could put on good matches. Why wasn't he pushed more? And Vince wasn't. He could play the evil heel for Vince. He could fit that role for him, you know, in that short feud with Hogan, I believe he had, you know, when he was still the model, you know, Hogan versus foreign heel. That's the archetype. Martel could fit it because he was French and snobby, and nobody likes French and snobby guys, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, that's the simplistic way to look at Vince's thinking. And it's one of those, you know, in the era of the new generation / attitude era, you know, you had work rate guys, but they were still all about the gimmick and stuff. And especially in the early 90s when Vince is, I mean, I'm looking at house show results, and Martel was trashed with trying to get Duke Drozzi over. Because, of course, trash guy versus model with arrogance. Oh, I cannot stand the smell of this smelly trash man kind of a thing. There wasn't a lot of deep thinking going on in this. It's just, hey, Martel's a good hand. He always has been. He's always been agreeable to do business. So we're here. To kind of pivot to the match, Martel's a great fiery babyface, and I absolutely love that the hot shot, which was one of my favorite moves as a kid when Eddie Gilbert did it, leads to the end of this match.
Match, yeah. No, this finishing sequence is great. Saruta, that knee Saruta hits towards the end of the match is no nonsense.
It does get the visual kick out at 3.1, which is kind of part and parcel to the agreement that, hey, we need to please a lot of people with this, and they always were showing the dignitaries around the ring and stuff like that. There were a lot of political issues with this match, one would assume.
Yes, many considerations were occurring in this match.
It was a very simple match too. I mean, it told a very simple story, and I liked it. Yeah.
Saruta's the bigger, more established champion, and he wanted to bully Martel around a little bit. Martel picks up the pace.
Ricky Martel.
All right. Well, there is a period of time, too, where Ricky Martel kind of looks like Ricky Martin. Like, there's a slight convergence period of time.
But nothing tells you young white meat babyface
Ricky.
Like the nickname Ricky, as opposed to Rick or Richard.
I was going to say, like, anytime you put a Y at the end of the name, like, you know, when Mike becomes Mikey, he's a young white meat baby face. When John becomes Johnny, he's a young white meat baby face. When Mark becomes Marky, he's a young white meat baby face.
If Sami Zayn ever gets old and grizzled, I want him to be Samuel Zayn, even though it's not his name. I enjoyed this. I'm enjoying your odd fascination with old AWA. I am.
Yeah, I'm also just trying to ping and pong around different talents that we haven't looked at. I'm using this now as like a let's find some really stiff meat mountain matches, and I'm using it more as like let's take a look at different wrestlers and different styles and stuff, and just like even have a conversation around, you know, whether it's like work shoot matches or Rick Martel or Mr. Perfect or whatever. Like, you know, I've done most of my favorite wrestlers, and now it's fun to actually just take a week and like just look at, okay, let's do some Rick Martel this week. Because I watched the Booker T and Rick Martel match, and that was exceptional.
That was good.
That was a great match. Like, he's really good. I think this guy had a great career. So like that, this was lovely.
Yeah, mine tends to be, you know, like a Monday or Tuesday, if something caught my eye, I'll try and think of something from the past to get there. Like if I saw something on Raw or NXT that gets my mind flown. But I'm going to warn you, I've gone a little bit down a Mongo rabbit hole. And I've watched a sequence with him and the Barbarian.
Oh, I know. You actually need say no more. I know exactly the sequence. It's hilarious.
I may have to visit that.
I'm so down. Let's go.
So we'll get there.
Say no more. I know exactly of the match. It's like 96 Nitro.
There's a little bit of a disagreement there, I think, on how things should go. And Mongo and Barbarian are just going to fight their way out of it. And it's something, man. So let's end Shake Them Ropes there. I am Jeff Hawkins. You can follow me at CrepGame13 on X. You can also just follow the show at Shake Them Ropes. If I get Vader Club in time, I will generally post the match there. I don't know if I'm going to post this one. I like it. It's just one of those things where I don't like clogging feeds with anything other than the show. So that's how you follow it, simply like that. I also do the Dynamite show over on Fight Game Media about 20 minutes after Dynamite goes off the air. Paul Fontaine of Figure Four and Wrestling Observer and I do a thorough deconstruction of that week's AEW. Drops in your podcatchers for free the next morning. We're soon going to be watching with Garrett Gonzalez of Fight Game / Figure Four, the very first Double or Nothing, and critiquing that. And there are some things in that still permeate to today. In many ways, more than one, Chris. It's an interesting show for a number of reasons, and that should be dropping sometime in early April. We're going to do the review of that. Chris has interests and things that he'd like to sell you, so he's going to tell you about it now.
Yeah, please. So if you are so interested this summer, I am going to be doing a summer music course on it's entitled Human Songwriting. Specifically, we are going to be talking about how to write songs, but in the backdrop of AI and artificial intelligence creating music. What does it mean for the future of songwriters? You'll dig this, Jeff. Actually, one of my students demonstrated for me this week that Suno.ai app, you can prompt it to do copyright infringement. It will actually straight up steal lyrics, and he's now done it for me twice. We're working on...
It's like sampling, but different.
No. Yeah, this was literally taking Sarah McLachlan's Little Earthquakes and just putting new music to it over the lyrics, and with copyright law being words and music, that is straight up copyright infringement.
Is Little Earthquakes Sarah McLachlan or Tori Amos?
Tori Amos. Okay. Yeah, there we go.
Sorry to correct you on that.
No, you're fine. I actually, my joke about the lyrics was, man, maybe the computer should have written this one too. don't cheat off the homework, kids. Learn how to do it for real. So if you're interested in taking the songwriting class, please message me on Instagram. I'll be doing that starting in June. I know it's still a ways off, but just wanted to get that across everyone's stratum. New music will be coming out here very soon. We are in the final process of mixing and then doing the mastering on my new song, Olive Branch. I've been recording some other stuff too. So busy time in the music hopper. Great time to subscribe to the Spotify. Great time to learn guitar. Great time to be alive.
I'll tell you this, the George Foreman Grill is a good panini press.
Hello there, everybody. It's me, Gary Kidney, the co-host of You've Got to Be Kidding Me on the Voices of Wrestling Podcasting Network.
And I am Liam Jones, my full name, and I'm also a part of the Voices of Wrestling Podcasting Network as a co-host for You've Got to Be Kidding Me.
We are a TNA history podcast that covers TNA 1 month at a time. We cover all the drama, all the matches, all the Vince Russo nonsense you could ever want in your life.
Have you heard of TNA? I bet you have, but would it be funnier if two people made jokes over it the whole time? Probably.
So if that sounds like fun to you, check it out on this very Voices of Wrestling Podcasting Network, and Liam will do bits and whatnot.